Sorry for the delay. The organizer has not yet arrived. You will be placed on hold until the organizer arrives. Please remain on the line.
This line is now off hold.
You have entered as an attendee in listen-only mode.
I ordered a report from the Friedberg Mercantile Group. I'm David Rosberg, and with me this morning is Al Friedberg. Good morning, Al. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning. Good morning, David.
It's July 21st, and before we get going, just a little bit of housekeeping as we try to do before every call. We're going to keep the call to about 45 minutes. The call will be posted on the Friedberg website and also on the Niagara website as soon as we're done, within about a half an hour. I'm going to act as a bit of an interlocutor and ask Al a few questions. Most of the questions are questions that have been sent by you, the investors, and that I've reshaped. Can't think if there's anything else to attend to. Without anything coming to mind, let's get right to it. Al.
Yep.
Most of the questions, not surprisingly given the context, but surprising given that we're a hedge fund who's looking for absolute returns, relate to stocks and bonds, the most traditional part of the investment the investment horizon. In your letter, in your second quarter report, you talk about the fund being net long equities to the tune of over 90%. And as one of our partners points out, this exposure must surely rank amongst the highest the fund has had in years, if not ever. Stocks are trading at very lofty multiples. Many hedge funds disagree with the way you are looking at equities from the long side. What lies at the base of this call? Do you have a better handle on economic growth and earnings growth than most analysts, or what's the story?
Okay, David, thank you. Okay, that is true. The question has been asked many times, and I have to go back to one idea that I think is now a very important one. That is, stocks are like bonds and other assets. We can only compare one to the other. They're relative to one another. You can't speak about one asset being overvalued or undervalued unless you speak about what's the alternative, what's the comparison, and what is it compared to.
It turns out you're talking about not one stock to another. You're talking about comparing stocks to bonds.
Classes of assets, correct. Classes of investment assets. And when you look at today's stock prices, most people would say, well, stock prices are trading at 20 times earnings, at least trailing earnings. And that's expensive, and it is expensive in historical terms. The only thing is that when you compare it to, let's say, fixed income, stocks are actually cheap because interest rates are today also historically very, very low. We haven't had interest rates like this in maybe in history. Certainly, we haven't had this type of this kind of. We haven't had levels like these, let's say, the 10-year or the 30-year maturities than we have had, than maybe even during the Depression. So when you compare stocks to bonds, stocks are actually cheap. And a very simple calculation for me is, and that's the way I look at them, is if I was a long-term investor, I would want to have I would want to put some money in stocks, some money in bonds, but let me see what can I expect of stocks and what can I expect of bonds. If I take tips as being the best measure of what I can expect in fixed income returns and adjusted by inflation or taking into account inflation expectations, we're looking at 30-year tips yielding no more than about 65 basis points, and the 10-year may be somewhere around 15 to 25, depends on the issue. So you're making a minimal return after inflation expectations. If you look at stocks and they're trading at 20 times earnings, the earning yield is 5%, the reverse of 20 times earnings. Is 5%. So stocks are trading at a very significant are not trading. They are providing a very significant premium in returns over fixed income, somewhere between 4.5 and 4.75% above what you might get in fixed income, and that's a very high. That's a very high risk premium. So this is the reason why stock prices continue to move higher. This is the reason that they continue to move higher despite all the problems that we are aware of, political problems and all kinds of other problems and concerns about earnings. We've had 5 quarters in a row of earnings dropping or earnings being below dropping. And yet the market is holding and making new highs. And there is a tremendous amount of skepticism in this rally while markets are making new highs. But the beyond all this and behind all this is the fact that stock today cheap. And so because of that, I felt that it is worthwhile for us to be as close as possible as 100% invested. Now, that doesn't mean that we are really 100%. We are 100%, but it's made up as of being 150% long and 50% short. So the effect is not quite 100% as the net numbers would imply because of the different volatility of the different elements. But it is as close as it's certainly the highest net exposure that we have had in quite a number of years. And that's, I think that's a simple answer. There's no other answer. I don't know any more than anybody else knows about growth, GDP growth for the coming few quarters. I don't know anything more than anybody else knows about earnings. All I'm saying is, in a relative comparison, stocks are a very cheap investment alternative.
Now, could you not have made this argument since 2009?
You mean after the market went down?
Yeah, if you compared the earnings yield of equities to the yield on the 10-year or the TIP, would not the same argument have held?
But are you saying at the peak of 2007 or after the market went down?
At the trough of 2009.
At the 2009, yes. At the trough of 2009, if one were actually focusing on that measure, and it's probably true that you would have found stocks to be cheap. And I don't even know, and David, I haven't gone back and I haven't looked at it, I don't even know whether that was true even before, meaning even through the early 2000s. It seems to me that it was true even then. But the QE only began in maybe 2011, and it's only then that you had this exaggerated move in interest rates, and which made the comparison so much more attractive than before.
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about interest rates in a moment, and also for those of you who've sent questions, after interest rates, we're going to talk a little bit about gold. We're going to talk about other assets that Al has in both the Global Macro Fund and in the Asset Allocation Fund. And we're going to talk about some currencies, in particular the Canadian dollar and the Mexican peso. But before we get there, just to satisfy the concerns of a great many of our partners who ask basically this question, what are the risks to this asset-friendly scenario? We have Brexit. We have China. We have Italian banks. We have Donald Trump, and we have his wife in her dress and in her speech. What are these? Are you concerned about any of these risks, or does the equity risk premium, to borrow a pun, trump all these other issues?
Some of the concerns, I would say that some of those concerns are not really concerns. For instance, Brexit was not a concern for us. Other concerns, more fundamental concerns, for example, the very high level of debt at the sovereign level and at the corporate level, those are concerns. And as long as interest rates remain at where they are today, you could probably defer the moment, the final moment of reckoning. any of these European countries, or and a large number of corporations would not be able to survive if interest rates were normalized, if rates would be 300, 400 basis points higher than they are today. So the Achilles heel of this market, of all the markets, is interest rates. And the determinant of where interest rates are going to be is really the rate of inflation. So if we boil it down to it, it's essential. The single largest risk that we have today is an acceleration of inflation. That's the single largest risk. All the other risks, and of course I'm not saying all, because there are some things that there's some things that are totally unpredictable that can happen and could be enormous. The important military events and political events are of enormous importance. But what we see and what we know, of all the things that we see and we know, the only thing that concerns me is an acceleration of the rate of inflation. And when that happens, I think central banks will start changing their tune. They will have to change their tune. They will have to start getting a little more aggressive on rates. And even if they didn't, long rates, 10-year maturities, 15-year, 20, 30-year maturities will begin to reflect this concern. And the yield curve will steepen substantially. And that is the largest risk, the single largest risk to the whole picture.
Now, you are you were raised in Latin America, where you and your family had to live under the bane of inflation. You're very sensitive to inflation, and I know that you're sensitive to inflation gauges today. If this is the greatest risk, in your view, how likely is that risk? What are you looking at, and what do you sense out there?
Well, I think that it is becoming, it has been becoming, let's say, for the past few years, more real, the risk. And one of the reasons why we haven't seen an acceleration of the rate of inflation, we have seen inflation, but not accelerating, is that central banks, for all their quantitative easing, for all their accommodations in monetary policy, have not been able to, let's put it this way, it has not been transformed into an increase in monetary aggregates. We haven't seen money supply in most of the major countries. We haven't seen money supply increase substantially. And the main reason is that the banking system itself, which produces this increase in deposits, using the reserves provided to them by the central banks, have not been aggressive in lending money out for a number of reasons. Either there are regulatory reasons, there are new constraints on bank lending and bank balance sheets every day. New constraints, how much capital they need to have to expand their balance sheets, and we've had adjustments to those numbers every few months, and so it's very difficult for banks to even plan ahead expansion of balance sheets. And at the same time, we have also had banks that are nervous and almost traumatized by what happened about 6 or 7 years ago, where they took enormous losses in derivatives and lending, and so are much more careful in the way they extend loans. So, in short, all that tremendous monetary expansion, central bank monetary expansion, has not translated into a substantial expansion in money supply, what we call money supply. And as a result, inflation has remained relatively quiescent. However, in the past, I would say in the past year or so, we have seen that money supply in the U.S. has begun to creep higher from about a 6% rate of growth, let's say, in the broad aggregates. We're getting closer to 8%. In Europe, we are moving over 5% per annum from negative rates. And even in Japan, broad money has not increased much, and that's because of the broken banking system maybe. But we've seen narrow money moving up rapidly in the past few months. China continues to China will continue to see increase in money supply year after year after year of 15% per annum, which eventually have an effect, will have an effect. And so when you look at the global picture, you are beginning to see a rise of money, the transformation of this reserve money that was created by central banks into more money, more private deposits, and that will drive inflation higher. Now, we are getting also closer in some countries like the UK and United States to full employment. That means that we are starting to see pressures in the labor market. Wages are starting to rise. My guess is that the inflation will not come first from there. It will probably come first from rising prices in commodities, and we are seeing that. If you're watching commodities, you will see that for the past 6 months at least, they've had a fairly pronounced up move. It's broadening. The advance is broadening. It's many different commodities are rising in price. And so probably, and commodities are very sensitive to inflation, so that probably we'll see that spill over eventually into what we call consumer prices. It may take a little time. I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of this year, our CPI rates will, our core, which is running close to 2% a year, will probably be running at 2.5%, 2.75% a year towards the end of the year. And maybe central banks are happy with that, with those numbers. They do want to create a little more inflation. They have said that. But I believe that once we get past 2.75%, perhaps, or 3%, you will see rates having to rise. And so the whole picture will begin to change as rates normalize. And they will only normalize, at least normalize, if we see inflation rising. And I do think, and I do believe that we will see that happening very soon.
So to summarize then, this long position that we have in, that you have in the Global Macro Fund and the fairly concentrated or high level of allocation to equities in the asset allocation fund is a function of the equity risk premium, which will change unquestionably as interest rates rise in response to any showing of inflation, and it's to that that it's there that your focus is.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. Before we turn to commodities, and in particular gold, just tie this one up with interest rates. One of our partners noted in a question, he was brought up with the notion that there's no free lunch, and I'm sure that everyone in the call subscribes to that homily. We have now, in some countries, in particular Japan, the government buying its own bonds. That's as close to a free lunch as I can imagine. How does this end? What happens now to all this money that's being created by central bankers, and in particular this purchasing and retiring of bonds in Japan, and perhaps even the depositing of helicopter money, of the Ben Bernanke helicopter money, by central banks both in Europe, maybe even in the United States, and in Japan as well?
Well, one of the things that we've been talking about is that Japan buying back debt, in effect, is canceling the debt, right? So what looked at one time impossible, which is this mountain of debt that Japan had as a ratio of GDP, was the highest ratio in the industrialized world. In effect, by the central bank being able to buy back those bonds, it's like the right hand of the government is lending money to the left hand, and they're canceling those bonds. And so very soon Japan will have a much, already today, on a net basis, Japan has a much better debt profile than it had before. They have bought back the bonds.
But isn't this simply an interchange of long-term money for short-term money?
Well, yes, it is. And that's the point. It is not a free lunch, because that exchange of long bonds for short-term money, for because what they're doing is they actually printing money to buy those bonds, eventually finds its way into the private sector, and when it does, it creates inflation. So it looks free at the moment, but it's not free, because what it means is that all those bonds that were bought back, it's the same as, or you have to almost imagine it, is the same as if the government had originally, when they went into deficit, instead of borrow the money, they could have printed the money, correct? They could have just simply set the
right.
Print the money and finance my deficit. Well, we're doing that now. We're sort of going backwards in time, and we're doing that now. And so what happens is, at some point, that money ends in the hands of the consumer and businesses, and will create inflation. So yeah, it's not free, and the end of it is, and this is why we're so concerned about it, the end of it is, of course, inflation.
At the present time, one of your long bets happens to be on the Nikkei. It was an unpopular bet. It's been a very unpopular bet amongst your hedge fund colleagues for the past several months. But in the last few weeks in particular, it's paid off handsomely for you. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Well, there's the same thing, the same equity risk premium that we talked about before. Stocks in Japan are priced very, very well. Actually, even in absolute terms, they're priced well, at least compared to their past 25 or 30-year history. And in relative terms, compared to fixed income, they're priced extremely well. They're attractive. Japanese companies are now buying back stocks in big way for the first time in a long time. I think that by the end of this year, they will have bought close to 7 trillion yen of stock. So between the government buying some ETFs besides bonds and companies buying back stock, stocks are a very attractive proposition today for the global investor and for the Japanese and for the domestic investor. And I believe that it may take a little bit of time, but I think that we will see that market do much better in the next while.
Have you been playing any Pokemon Go?
Yeah, we actually own a position in Nintendo that we bought 6 months ago, and it's done very well.
No kidding. Let's move on to an old standard, the oldest standard in the investment universe, gold. You've been a long-term gold bull. You originally bought gold because you looked at it as debt-free money, and you were worried in particular about issues emanating from the Chinese credit bubble. More recently, you talked about gold benefiting from perhaps the next move in inflation upwards, and yet post Brexit, you made a great call. You liquidated virtually your entire position of the metal. You kept, if I'm not mistaken, a goodly portion of your gold mining equities. Can you talk about where you stand with gold?
Well, yes. The drivers behind gold are A, inflation or accelerating inflation, and B, credit. If global credit is creaking, if we have problems in global credit, if we have defaults in global credit, if sovereigns begin to default, I think gold becomes ever more valuable. And many central banks around the world are recognizing this and are actually beginning to increase their reserves, their gold reserves. We've seen this happen for the past at least 3 years, that we have net buying by central banks. So those are the two forces behind the rise in the price. I believe that that will continue, and that, of course, will over time will accelerate, and so we're going to see a very strong gold market over the next few years. But short term, sometimes the market gets a little bit carried away, and I believe that it did get carried away now with Brexit, because it almost seemed like it was the end of the world, and the gold buying was crazy, was indiscriminate, and I'm not really sure why people thought that gold would go up in a situation where Britain is deciding to confront or to negotiate their way out of the European Union, or to negotiate a better deal. I'm not sure why the market got so excited, but it presents an opportunity for us to trade, and so we did, and we sold our gold position, our futures and bullion gold positions. We did not sell the gold mining stocks that we own. We actually took a small profit in some of them, but very small, and kept the majority of the mining stocks. And the reason is, number one, the asset allocation fund is even a longer-term holder, a longer-term player with longer-term horizons, even in the global macro. It's less of a trader, and it's a little harder to move in and out of mining stocks than it is to move in and out of futures. But our decision was the market had overdone, it overreached temporarily, and we're now watching it and seeing whether there's another entry point coming. There probably will be an entry point in the next, I'd say, 4-8 weeks, and in anticipation of what may happen in Europe in October, where we have, for example, Italian referendum in Italy, and that, or in elections where we can see parties that do not want to stay in the EU once again put pressure on the European Union, and that may be another occasion for gold to move higher. And of course, if we start seeing inflation numbers, bigger and strong inflation numbers, we'll see gold do well.
Okay, thanks. I want to circle back for a second to interest rates, only because I've got an email here as we've been talking about the purchasing of government debt. We've been talking about about the Japanese government buying its own bonds. What's happening in the United States? One of our partners wants to know as far as that goes. Has the Fed been buying its own bonds? Not yet, but have they talked about it?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that. Has it what?
Has the Fed spoken about buying its own bonds like Japan has, or have you heard anything about that?
No. The Fed ended its QE, its quantitative easing operation, and I think their balance sheet is very, very steady. At most, I think they replaced the maturing bonds, but their portfolios remain fairly steady. They have not bought any more, they have not bought more bonds, and I don't see anywhere that they're talking about doing that. If anything, they have shifted to a slightly tighter posture when they raised Fed funds rate once, and now they may decide to do it again. So, no, I think the Fed is not talking about doing any of that.
Okay. Here's a very interesting question that could be put to any discretionary manager, because I think that it's the greatest risk that every discretionary manager faces, and that is there an unconsciously or perhaps consciously a particular theme that runs through the entire portfolio? In other words, I know that in setting up the portfolio of both funds, what you're wanting to do, to the extent that it's possible, is to have returns that are uncorrelated from the various assets that you've made bets on. But is it possible that, without realizing it, you have a single theme that's crept into the portfolio? And if so, what do you think it might be, and how do you guard against that?
Well, yes, there is. Let's say, for the most part, for the greater part of the portfolio, there is a general tendency to bet on this idea that we are going to see a gradual increase in inflation. And actually, in some ways, you might say many of these positions are betting on that. But for example, let's talk about our equity position. We have a long
right. I mean, you seem that you said quite the opposite at the outset, that inflation would be damaging for the equity position because
right.
it would imply rising rates.
Right. So the idea is we want to be in that early stage where inflation is sort of accelerating and is still not being there's no official reaction to it or no strong official reaction to it. For example, housing is predicated on the fact that there's been very little housing built. That is a shortage. There's a very, very – inventories are very low, very, very low. Prices in housing have been going up 5 to 6% a year in the past 2 years. They were going up even faster before that. So clearly the housing bid is predicated on rising prices, more volume, better margins. But rising prices is part of that. And, you know, if houses were declining, I don't think that people would be buying houses and therefore the business would not be a good business. So there is a bet you might call a bet on at least gently rising prices there. The same is true for our natural gas liquids and natural gas bets. They're a commodity play, so they're certainly betting on some sectoral strength in the commodity market, but also the general tendency that commodity prices will go higher. In our commodity portfolio, we have a commodity portfolio that our commodity manager has been instructed to be long only, and we have a long exposure of between 15 and 22% of net assets. Well, there are long metals, there are long some soft commodities, there are long some grains. There, too, there is a more direct bet on on inflation. So,
God bless.
I would say that the portfolio is structured towards not a huge rise in inflation. We're not really speaking about that. We're speaking about a gently rising inflation rate that lifts these underlying commodities. But of course, if it starts picking up momentum and we start seeing a very strong acceleration of inflation, some of these will not do well anymore. For example, housing won't do very well if we see a very strong rise in inflation, because then it will have an impact
mortgage
on
rates.
Mortgage rates, and then of course mortgage rates will impact the housing. So it is structured towards taking advantage of this early stage of accelerating inflation, which it can last. And by the way, that has also to do with the fact of how the Fed reacts. It is possible that the Fed will see with glee almost that inflation rate is going up, and that they do want to see inflation rates go over 3% maybe, and maybe over more than 3% before they react. And simply because that eats away the real burden of debt, and all countries around the world are interested in seeing that their oppressive burden of debt that they have now gets eaten away by rising inflation, and that would be the ideal solution for most countries. And so it's possible that in the early stages the Fed will react, but with a lag. And if they react with a lag, it gives us even more time to stay invested, quote unquote, stay invested in inflation.
Okay, thanks. Let's turn to some miscellany. In the quarterly report, you talked about, I'm quoting, the more interesting side of the fund story lies in the performance of our other assets. What are those other assets? What are those interesting positions, and how are they related or not related to this theme of inflation?
Well, we have a lot of interesting other assets. For example, we have a very strong position in both funds, global macro and asset allocation, in Brazilian local bonds. Local currency bonds, which I talked about in the previous quarterly. At the time that we took a position, they were around 14%, they're yielding around 14%, talking about 10-year local currency bonds. They have done well. They're now trading around 11.8, 11.75. That means the bonds have gone up. We have hedged the currency portion so that I guess we could have made more money had we not hedged it, but that was not the play. The play was seeing that in Brazil's case, interestingly enough, we were expecting inflation rates to go down. And we believe that inflation rates are going down and will be going down a lot faster than expected by the government and by the central bank. And that will eventually be reflected in a central bank lowering the bank rate, which is above 14% today, and these bonds can trade to yield maybe 7 to 8%. So that's a play that is actually that has no connection almost to our main general theme, but we believe is a powerful play, and that's what we've given it. We own something like a 27 or 28% exposure to net asset value, so it's an important play for us. Other things that we have, I talked about Greek banks. We have bought some Greek banks. Net, so far, we're down a little bit. I believe that they represent very good value, and they would become even better value, I believe, if Greece left the European Union in a sharp, very sharp economic recovery and reflation would take place for the first 2 or 3 years. I think during that period, that short period, 2 or 3 years, you see these banks do very well. But even staying within the EU, the Greek banks are getting well treated now. They get good discount rates, and hopefully the economy will recover, or is recovering slowly, so they'll make some money. At any rate, priced as they are at 20 or 25 cents of book, I believe that they're a very good deal. And then we have some other interesting things. So for example, we recently put in a bet to we bought pounds against euros. We believe that the UK will come out of this very well and will do much better than the European Union. And I believe that at the very least, the pound will recover all the lost ground over the past 3 months, and over the next few years, maybe even more. So what we did is we did an option strategy, a put spread on the euro, and that was a euro pound put spread. And if it works out well, it could be very significant to the fund. At the same time, we did the same thing with the Chinese yuan, which we believe that it's only a matter of time before they have to devalue. And when they do, and they do in a more significant way than they've done till now, we should be able to make some money. Again, we use options there to limit our risk and to give us a good upside. I mean, these are positions that are not within the general theme. I might add that we have...
Oh, you're drifting away from the phone. I can't hear you very well.
I'm sorry. I might add... Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I might add that we also have a bet on U.S. interest rates. And we saw that the cheapest way to bet on rising interest rates in the U.S. is buying future euro dollar interest rate contracts, which are pricing in almost no raise in rates for a year and a half. So, you know, we have sold December 17 Eurodollar interest rates, and I believe very small risk, but a lot of upside if rates normalize. So those are examples of some of the things that are not in the main, other than the Eurodollar interest rates, but not in the main line of our or theme underlying some of the positions that we have now. And
I guess I query a little bit on the pound euro spread and on the as it relates to the Greek banks. One of the ways that the pound euro spread could work out for you would be if the euro were to come under pressure as a result of, say, the banking crisis or the banking issue in Italy not being resolved. In which case the pound might stay stable, but the euro could collapse against it. But if that were the case, if the eurozone were to disintegrate further, if Greece were to leave the euro, would your investment in those banks not be denominated in drachma?
Right, but the important thing is that maybe they would be redenominated, and the way you redenominate, I mean, there are many, many combinations and permutations of how to leave the euro. What does it mean to leave the euro? Maybe the one thing that will keep is the common currency, and get out of all the other obligations. It's very hard to know what will happen, but if they redenominate assets and liabilities in a different currency, I don't think that would be a terrible problem. The important thing would be what happens to business when the National Bank of Greece is able to retake a sovereignty when it comes to printing money and when it comes to monetary policy. And so that could be explosive, actually, for the Greek economy. We have seen many countries around the world that after devaluing or getting out of a fixed rate scheme that they had with other nations, have done extremely well, at least for a couple of years. In Greece's case, because they lack a lot of discipline, that's an understatement. It's not likely that it will result in it will have good results in the long run, but in the short run it can have a very sharp impact, upward impact on economic activity and even stocks.
Okay, we're going to wind up here. We've got just a few minutes left, and I'm going to wind up with a question about a position that you don't have, but that a partner who is in his own right a good speculator wants to put to you. It's regarding the Canadian dollar and oil, in particular how it relates to the Mexican peso. It makes the point that the peso offers a high yield and competes with Canada in a free trade zone. Is it cheap now, perhaps because of Trump?
I don't have any strong views on those markets, and I mean, with regards to oil, I think that oil could reach a little higher. I think that oil can get into the 60s, and before it meets another wall of production. But I don't really know what effect it will have. It's likely that it will have a bullish effect on things like on currency like the Canadian and Mexico, but there are other things, there are other factors too, and I don't really have a view on I don't have a view on the Canada, nor do I have a view on the Mexican peso. I've looked at the Mexican economy and Mexican peso for many years, and have not found anything attractive enough for us to make a play on anything there. So I can't really comment with any kind of conviction on any of these positions.
Okay, fair enough. Al, your global macro fund is up in the neighborhood of 6.5-7%, if I'm not mistaken. By comparison to the S&P, it's outperformed, and by comparison to your global macro peers and to hedge funds in general, you've outperformed. Your asset allocation fund is up close to 20%. You're knocking the lights out. Congratulations. And on behalf of all of us, keep it up. Thanks for the good call.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Have a good day.
Have a good day. So this concludes the call. Listeners, just a reminder that the call will be posted on the Friedberg and the Niagara website. And on behalf of both Niagara and Friedberg, we wish you a good quarter in investing. Thanks.